even the most hapless human would make. Subjectively, the inner conscious life of an artificial intellect, if it has one, may also be quite different from ours. For all these reasons, one should be wary of assuming that the emergence of superintelligence can be predicted by extrapolating the history of other technological breakthroughs, or that the nature and behaviors of artificial intellects would necessarily resemble those of human or other animal minds. All right, so I think I will move on, and I do want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and today I'm joined by Brandon Brownlee and Kira Tianen, and we're talking about what is superintelligence. Okay, so, and what is superintelligence? Well, super, Latin meaning above, intelligence meaning behavior of human being that is better than other behavior of other human being. So, very, very simply, and I am playing with words a little bit here, we're looking at intelligence that is above human capacity and what that is as an intellectual concept and what are the philosophical implications of such a complex, and the necessary implications that might come by realizing a superintelligence if it is implemented in different life domains and different situations. Okay, so I would like to move on to superintelligent moral thinking, which I think my co-hosts will probably have some opposition to, but I could be wrong, we'll see. To the extent that ethics is a cognitive pursuit, a superintelligence could do it better than human thinkers. This means that questions about ethics, insofar as they have correct answers that can be arrived at by reasoning and weighting up of evidence, could be more accurately answered by a superintelligence than by humans. The same holds for questions of policy and long-term planning. When it comes to understanding which policies would lead to which results and which means would be most effective in attaining given aims, a superintelligence would outperform humans. This is assuming that the superintelligence is given a level playing field with humans in terms of how it is able to interact and understand the world. That's an assumption. I don't want to be too hard because we do need to suspend our disbelief a little bit to understand this topic. Okay, so continuing on. There are therefore many questions that we would not need to answer ourselves if we had or were about to get superintelligence. We could delegate many investigations and decisions to the superintelligence. For example, if we are uncertain how to evaluate possible outcomes, we could ask the superintelligence to estimate how we would have evaluated these outcomes if we had thought about them for a very long time, deliberated carefully, had more memory and better intelligence, and so forth. When formulating a goal for the superintelligence, it would not always be necessary to give a detailed, explicit definition of this goal. We could enlist the superintelligence to help us to determine the real intention of our request, thus decreasing the risk that infelicious wording or confusion about what we want to achieve would lead to outcomes that we would disapprove of in retrospect. So, essentially, super intelligence would be able to be a guide or a mentor in human decision making, specifically in regards to moral behavior. I don't know if this is the best way of thinking about this, but how I would explain a little bit of this is if you imagine, and I know this is dating me a little bit, if you imagine a world before YouTube, or before YouTube was as widely as accepted or used as it was now, and you wanted to learn how to do something, how to speak a language, how to create a paper airplane, you might, and I guess this is also before search engines, you know, you might go to a book, you might go to a search engine, you might go to any number of technologies to achieve that goal of learning about that specific topic. YouTube by creating an environment where people actually have, you know, financial incentive and have enough benefit, if they're good enough at talking about a specific subject, they can actually teach subjects professionally through YouTube, through short form or long form videos. And so that has dramatically altered the way people engage with information and learn about information. And the reason I'm talking about YouTube specifically is it's not that uncommon for people to say, like, it's quite uncommon to say, like, I was thinking about this moral decision and I went to YouTube for moral advice. That's pretty rare these days. But if it's a question on, like, go ahead, Kira.
Sorry, you bring up when you say already, there's this really interesting concept that some people believe that when you appeal to authority, you've already given up your responsibility and autonomy because you've already answered for yourself the answer that you're looking for by going to that authority. And that is kind of the part with artificial ethics that I think is the most important part, to kind of remember that we're not committing philosophical suicide and losing all meaning by giving control to the AI.
That is a very good point of, if we were to use a superintelligence to make better decisions, specifically in moral domains, are we then giving up one of the most, or if you could argue, I think very powerfully, that is the most important human pursuit, which is to know how to make your own decisions, irrespective of authority. Difficult point. This is kind of, although I wasn't wanting to make the exact same point with YouTube, the point that I wanted to make there was that if we want to, in kind of a domain where there are a little bit less stakes, if you want to learn about something today, there are a variety of high-quality short-form videos that you can easily access through the technology of YouTube because of the development of its recommendation algorithm and the people who have participated with that platform. So how does this relate back to superintelligence? Well, imagine what something like ChatGPT might be in 10 years, or imagine what YouTube was when it started and what YouTube is now. When it first started, YouTube was short videos, you know, it was cat videos, it was funny jokes, it wasn't anything major. It wasn't like people were making hour-long videos introducing you to academic subjects and they had PhDs and they were putting those on YouTube for free. Now you can find those very, very, very easily. There are 15-minute videos by a variety of people who make content to educate online and in a variety of settings. And that's now widely available. And the recommendation algorithms make it so that the people who are interested in those things are able to find them somewhat easily and then are able to consistently find them and consistently engage with those creators. It's not an example of superintelligence. What it is an example of is technological adaption and technological evolution. It's really hard to think about how a superintelligence might be adopted and might evolve into a higher form of superintelligence. So I wanted to give us an example, kind of a very baseline common sense example, to get us started in that regard in terms of how something might be able to evolve. YouTube, when it got started, was, you know, it was just another video sharing site. Today, it's literally made billionaires, changed the way we interact online. It's become one of the predominant ways that I think human beings engage with each other. Obviously, there's podcasts and other things, but it has dramatically changed human society as a technology. Go ahead, Kira.
And I think that's where that's a point for me where I'm anti-social media and anti-connection that way, because it's developed so far that it no longer has credibility. And that's kind of like my biggest fear, is that a person can be so coerced into fake news and fake media that you learn the capacity to judge things for yourself because you're just accepting what the technology evolution has done for you out of ease.
I think lots of ways to jump off of that in different ways. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Brandon?
So I suppose if I'm to respond to the sort of YouTube example of, well, in the beginning it was just, because we're talking here about the way that this technology sort of evolves in light of the way that people engage with it. It's strange. I'm of two minds when I try to think about things like YouTube, because it's not really an isolated phenomenon. It is sort of a platform on the internet, which itself is an enormous piece of technology. So I have to think about the way that it's not just, oh, how are people using YouTube over time? People using YouTube over time is a new way of people using the internet over time. And I think that has a lot to do with the way that YouTube changed from a mere video sharing website to a media platform. So it's YouTube augmented the way that we use the internet. So you can inform the question of, well, what changed with YouTube? If you really do look into the question of, well, how did people's use of the internet change? And then you have to look into, like, okay, well, how did the internet close space around the world and whatnot? How did YouTube overcome, like, language barriers and stuff like that? I think those are the interesting questions about YouTube. But to go back to the super intelligent moral thinking, I knew I was going to approach this from the concept of the hypothetical imperative from Immanuel Kant, to begin reading this, to the extent that ethics is a cognitive pursuit, well, maybe ethics is a cognitive pursuit, but ethics doesn't have to be a cognitive pursuit. I mean, when I'm out there being in the world, being a moral agent, and I'm acting, my actions are more or less immediate. That means they're not mediated by cognitions. I'm making decisions with my body. I'm reading the world. I'm kind of thinking out there. I'm not clammed up in myself thinking, what should I do here? And then making a decision based on that. I'm actually, like, I'm out in the world acting. So not all ethics is covered by this, but I think Bostrom understands that. That's fine. But this, so Bostrom's talking about the hypothetical imperative in terms of, well, if you want X, then you do Y, right? That is what the hypothetical imperative is. So if you want X and Y is a necessary condition for achieving X, then you should do Y. That is your imperative, depending on the hypothesis that you want X. What I find really kind of pernicious about this is the second paragraph. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where, oh, like, let's say I want to, you know, I want to cure cancer or something, and super intelligence cure cancer for us. Okay, well, that means we have to do this awful thing. And it's like, oh no, I didn't know I wanted that. Can you help me revise what I wanted in light of the fact that, oh, all this terrible stuff that was going to follow was necessary to do this? I think what is kind of pernicious about this is that when you, because what Bostrom is saying is, well, the way that I formulated it, I don't really have to, I do have to think about the way that I formulate what I desire, but the superintelligence is more intelligent than I am. I can just get the superintelligence to tell me what I want, because it's smarter than me, it's more intelligent. I don't have to know what I want. I can just ask the superintelligence what I want, and then the superintelligence will tell me, here's what you want, and here's how to get what you want. I think that is, I'd have to think about further why I think that is particularly problematic, and I'm not being romantic about this in terms of, like, oh, I don't know my desires or something, or it's, you know, a kind of elevation of self-knowledge. I think self-knowledge is something virtuous. I think it's, if anything, it is something like a good in itself, but that still requires qualifications. But at the same time, there is something a bit pernicious when you have this hypothetical structure for ethics. If you want X, do Y. Well, if I no longer even need to elect for myself what X is that Y would achieve, then I'm not even my moral agency in this equation is essentially null and void. So I suppose that if the superintelligence is going to be helping us make moral decisions, it needs to help us to kind of eke out or refine or discuss our desires, but it can't do what Bostrom is saying. It can't actually tell us what we want if it's going to make us better moral agents, or if it's going to serve sort of a moral end. At that point, we're more or less relinquishing our sort of autonomy or our capacity to actually think, well, what do I want? Or, you know, what decisions do I want to make? Or what, you know, what value should I hold? Or what should I desire? Or something like that. I suppose it's in that general vein that I'm seeing something worth, like, legitimate philosophical concern here.
The YouTube recommendation algorithm, as we talked about ChatGPT having a super intelligent characteristic, and this is the wrong way of understanding super intelligence, because Bostrom is talking about super intelligence as something way, way, way beyond these things, but it's worthwhile for us mainly because it's just low-hanging fruit. So in the same way that ChatGPT can answer questions on a broader breadth of knowledge better than any encyclopedia can, in the same way that an encyclopedia can know things about many, many, many different topics, the YouTube recommendation algorithm is able to understand a person's motivations, behavior, and serve them what they want in a way that was previously not possible. And this is true for basically every other major social media platform. The reason why one of the reasons why social media can be so addictive and so potentially dangerous, although I'm not against social media, I do think that it has a role to play in society, although the question of what that role it should play and how it should play that role, I think, are very important questions. Also, who should participate in social media and who should not participate in social media, because that's an in-group, out-group question, which is it's a really nasty question to think about morally, but fundamentally speaking, you have to think about, we shouldn't allow some bad actors on some platforms, or if we do allow them, we need to have a recommendation algorithm that knows how to deal with those types of things. So the reason, again, is that, so the YouTube recommendation algorithm is super intelligent in that sense. It is able to do things that no human is able to do, in a way that no human would be able to do, in a way that is we don't understand, even like the best engineers at Google who are currently working on the YouTube recommendation algorithm, they don't understand the whole picture of what it does and how it does it for people. So I'm not worshiping the YouTube recommendation algorithm as something, you know, beyond human. I'm trying to clarify that this is a technology that is already doing things that human beings aren't able to do. And in a way, human beings, by participating in using YouTube, they're giving up some of their moral choice to the recommendation algorithm. So basically they're saying by choosing what you want on YouTube and by consistently engaging in those behaviors, by just looking for what you want, it will give you more of what you want. But then fundamentally speaking, YouTube will never tell you what you should want and should not want. It will just encourage you to desire to spend as much time as you have available or are willing to spend on that specific platform in that specific way. Another thing that is worthwhile in thinking about is things like video game streaming and how that changes social dynamics for people. In early days, there basically was, you know, only one kind of socializing. Oh, that's a terrible way of saying it, because there's always, human societies are complicated. There's always different ways of interacting with people. But, you know, you had to do it person to person. And then, of course, we had mail systems. And then we had email. And then we had social media. And now we have streaming. And I think it's very interesting to me to think about what the implications of that are if we end up living in a society where most people don't interact with any other people most of their natural lives. Instead, what they do is they interact with technologies that then supplement human-like interactions.
This just reminds me a lot of the society's ability to control masses by teaching, or not teaching, but by allowing technology to be addictive in that way, where it's only giving you what you're willing to take in, instead of even being able to recommend things that are completely different than what your interests are. It alarms me into the feeling that society kind of ends up just becoming followers and incapable of making choice for themselves. That's the opposite of what this technology is doing.
I do think it's worth taking the other perspective a little bit, just to have a fair discussion, which is that, you know, YouTube has things called community guidelines that specify what kind of creators they want to have on their platform and what behavior they want their creators to engage in. And those types of things help benefit social media to being more beneficial and creating better human-like interactions. And there are different control mechanisms that we could introduce into systems or into the adoption of an artificial intelligence system or a superintelligence, or potentially a future superintelligence system, to do things like that. And I think that's why, honestly speaking, I've been very, very happy with seeing what OpenAI is doing in terms of trying to make ChatGPT a technology that will do things and won't do some things because it has some amount of moral guidance. Now, I know that there are quite a few people in the AI space who are saying, you know, OpenAI is not doing enough. They're not doing enough to protect the alignment of their technology to being aligned to human values. There are other several companies who are open competitors in the market with OpenAI, so there might be a slight conflict of interest there. In fact, some of the people who are running these new chatbot companies are people who formerly worked at OpenAI. So it's a very difficult question in terms of how do we best navigate what the best human values are in the new technologically enabled environment and society that we live in. And I think that's a very important discussion, and I think we're having part of that discussion here. But to go back to superintelligence changes that whole discussion. It changes that discussion from being about, you know, this is the technology, we know where it is, we know it's going to get faster, we know it will be more easy to use, but fundamentally speaking, there are limits of how good technology will be, and it will never replace some parts of what it means for us to be human. The counter perspective that is raised by a potential superintelligence is, no, technology will accelerate and change everything or the majority of things about what it means to be human and what it means to be in a human society, and that is something that we should think about. There is an element to this of, like, we can't put the jack back in the jackbox. We can't stop the acceleration of technologies that have been unleashed by the creation and the distribution of a technology like ChatGPT. And there are many people in our society today who would say we would be a fool to try to put it back in the box. We'd be a fool to try to say YouTube should never have existed, or other social media platforms should never have existed, just because they have some negative effects on society.
It should be more used with caution as a pleasure that can be also a vice, and how that can lead to further issues. And it's not that we shouldn't use it, but we should use it cautionally.
I guess to respond a little bit to the cautions about using media in certain ways, I mean, I think the kind of the metaphor of putting the jack back in the jackbox is a bit apt. You know, once the jack is sprung, things are different. It's not just that, like, the reason that it's a good cautionary tale is because after that point, things have changed. I mean, when you think about the way, so what's important to realize about technology is that technology is a change in the human condition, right? You can do something differently, or you have a new capacity depending on whatever technology you've adopted. So for example, if I have a hammer, I can now hit nails, right? Whereas before I would have to improvise some kind of suboptimal way of doing it. I have to hit it with rocks, or, you know, and once you have a hammer, you have an optimal tool for doing something. Once you have a machete, you can cut through things. You can't do that before. And once you can do something differently, it's not, I mean, you could just, you know, you could put the hammer down, you could put the machete down, but you can now do things differently. And the scope of your possibilities have changed, right? So it's not necessarily about just using it cautiously or using it in any certain way. It's about, okay, what does this technology enable us to do? What can I want to do with this technology, essentially? Because once you can do something, you can reflect on, well, do I want to do this? Do I want to do this? I might want to do something, but what if I don't want to do it? That would be a shocking revelation to you that, wow, I want to do something that I really don't want to do. And technology is the thing that made that possible. That, I think that is one of the things that is, that's one of the things that you can't sort of check for in just saying, well, just use it cautiously or don't use it cautiously. It changes your relationship to yourself because you can do things differently.
Thank you so much for listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Aaron Wang, and I've been joined by Brandon Brownlee and Kira Tianen.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Is Bird Note. Every hobby community has its lingo, and folks who love birds are no exception. Even the word bird has multiple meanings, says Rosemary Mosco, the author and illustrator behind a new book called The Birding Dictionary.
Bird, noun, a type of animal that is, by all scientific and objective measures, the best one. Verb, the worthy act of beholding a bird and giving it the time and attention it deserves.
Rosemary's tongue-in-cheek guide defines many of the terms that you might hear on a bird outing, like calling a particularly cute bird a burb, or shortening binoculars to just bins or knocks. And for anyone with doubts about who gets to use these words, she also included this entry.
Birder, noun, a person who engages in the hobby of spotting, listening to, and or otherwise perceiving birds. If you love observing birds, you're a birder. If you're new to the hobby, you're a birder. If you love birds but have never heard any of the slang or scientific jargon in this book before, you're a birder. If you're the type of person who judges other birders for not knowing enough about birds, you're still a birder, but you're also an ant. If you're a peregrine falcon and love observing birds, you're just hungry. I feel like there is no hobby where people are more nervous about calling themselves a part of it I try to reassure people, like, you are a birder and you belong in the community.
To all the birders out there, I'm Ariana Rimmel.